I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. This studio is located in Old City, Philadelphia, filled with museums and architecture that celebrate the city's colonial and Revolutionary War history. But there's another part of the city's past that doesn't draw tens of thousands of tourists every year or is even noticed by those of us who live and work in Philadelphia. Our guests, Joseph Elliott, Nathaniel Popkin, and Peter Woodall, call this period the long 19th century. This was when Philadelphia was a vibrant industrial hub with mills and factories, power stations, the Reading Railroad, theaters, churches, and clubs. Their book, Philadelphia: Finding the Hidden City, uncovers and celebrates the architecture and artifacts of that time, often hidden in plain sight, and it's published by Temple University Press. Nathaniel Popkin and Peter Woodall join us here in our Philadelphia studio. They wrote the text for the book, and they're co-founders of the web magazine Hidden City Daily. Nathaniel, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Great to
Peter,
be here.
Peter, nice to have you with us as well.
Thank you, Marty.
And joining us from Vermont Public Radio is Joseph Elliott. He did the photographs for this book. I should say they are quite beautiful. He's a professor of art at Muhlenberg College, also an instructor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Design. And Joseph Elliott, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Let me begin with you, if I could, Nathaniel. We were talking about this before going on the air. There are lots of East Coast cities that have the kind of history that Philadelphia has, but what makes Philadelphia a hidden city?
Well, I think we think about the city, we often think of it as being lost between New York and Washington. So we already have this sort of psychology of being hidden. We've been hidden from the mainstream of American life since about 1925, certainly by the Depression. But then we think about, okay, what are the factors that make up the hidden city that we talk about, some of which is monumental and quite large.
I mean,
right in your face, yet we don't understand it. And part of that is because Philadelphia in that long 19th century was one of the richest places in the world and rich enough to produce monumental things like giant department stores and giant mills and power stations, as you said before. And yet it also became, after the 1960s, through the economic collapse of deindustrialization, poor enough to leave these things, you know, not to erase them. And so here they are.
A kind of a strange gift that we are given. Let me quote Frank Taylor, who you quote in this book, and he wrote Poor Richard's Dictionary of Philadelphia. This goes back, Peter, to 1916. He writes, every second, 15 cigars. Every second, 10 loaves of bread, 10 pairs of stockings, 15 bushels of wheat loaded, a new saw, 1.5 yards of carpet, 50 daily papers printed. Every 2 seconds, a new hat. Every 3 seconds, a pair of lace curtains. Every 20 minutes, a new house erected. Every hour, a new trolley car built. Every 2.5 hours, a new locomotive constructed. He says, when Philadelphia gets into its working togs, it strikes a gait like this. This really takes us back to this thriving city.
Absolutely. It was an era when we were proud to call ourselves the workshop of the world. And that probably lasted up until World War II. After World War II, the industry left Philadelphia for the most part. And we didn't want to look back at that history necessarily. It was a source of pain for us. And we sort of replaced it by thinking a lot about our colonial history. So that history got lost. And I think now, finally, we're starting to look back and recover some of it, but of course it's a different sort of possessing of that history because we're not a big industrial power anymore.
Well, it's interesting to think of what Philadelphia must have smelled like, what it must have sounded like.
That's right.
A noisy place. Nathaniel?
Noisy, loud, bright. We're talking about, you know, neon everywhere. We're talking about movie houses on every neighborhood avenue. We're talking about 24-hour cafes, union halls where people were doing union organizing around the clock, training, education, a real profound public commercial life that was eviscerated or erased by the 1970s.
Joseph, let me get you in on the conversation as the photographer in our trio of guests here. What opportunities, and I have to say the photographs are just stunningly beautiful in this book, but what did you see as you photographed this part of Philadelphia?
Well, I've always been attracted to older places and older things. I think it's because of the kind of layers, the patina, the textures, the sort of build up over time of sort of color, tone, patina. So these kinds of places are just have been up my alley, you know, for many, many years. So it wasn't hard. When I first started photographing in Philadelphia in the early 2000s, I was working on some assignments from the National Park Service to document really significant structures, including some of the ones in the book, the Divine Lorraine Hotel, sure. The Wagner Free Institute, Girard College Founders Hall, and so on. But and those were my first introduction. I didn't have to seek them out. I was told where to go. And this is probably the case in most of the pictures in the book, most of the sites. Other people, as well as myself, have found them, you know, utterly fascinating and really significant in the history of architecture and urbanism. On the other hand, I found some places on my own. Of course, the big power plants, you know, out of the corner of your eye, it's not hard to notice if you have any, you know, if you're attuned at all to these sort of hulking places with smokestacks along the rivers that look kind of like railroad stations. And I'm, you know, utterly fascinated by that kind of monumentality, I guess, as Nathaniel said, and the kind of formality and thinking, well, how did these places end up looking like this?
Sure.
You know,
what
was it that developed? How did they develop? So, you know, my visual exploration sort of parallels the sort of more research-based, you know, research and study that Nathaniel and Pete have done over many years.
And this is not fair to listeners at all. I'm looking at the Richmond Generating Station that you have in this book, and it is glorious and decayed, and it's a mess, and you can almost smell and hear what it's probably like inside that building. Let me go to Wanamaker's. And as I was reading, I mean, I certainly remember Wanamaker's, but as I was reading about it, I was thinking, you know, it, in certain ways, kind of the Amazon of its day, that you could go to Wanamaker's and buy. It was built the late 19th century, buy most anything that you wanted, Nathaniel.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing the other day, actually, because John Wanamaker, you know, maybe he was the Jeff Bezos of his day. Sorry to the world, because he did pioneer techniques of selling that were great for the customer. So the best prices, the possibility of returning stuff, and the uplift of the shopper. I don't know if Amazon is into that, but that's the reason for the Oregon. It was to take a middle class person and turn shopping into this beautiful experience.
Absolutely. And you're nodding your head, Peter.
Yeah. I mean, I also think Wanamaker's is a good analog for the shopping mall. If you look at the gallery that was on Market Street in Philadelphia, you had all these different stores selling all these different things under one roof. How is that really different than a department store?
Sure.
Especially one like Wanamaker's that had everything from, you know, women's dresses to foreign novels.
All there for the purchase. And there's of course, there's the famous Oregon that hopefully people know about. Going back to you, Joseph, you have a photograph in here of the, 10,000 pipes that are part of the Wanamaker Oregon?
Yes, I actually think it's more like 20,000.
Is it really?
It's the more world's...
Like 30.
More like 30. The
30,
world's
000.
Largest,
okay,
largest pipe organ. Another, you know, it's a kind of artifact of the industrial age. I feel like being inside that organ is like sort of being inside a battleship or being inside a steel mill. It's like super heavy, heavyweight structural places. So that's I sort of knew what was in there, but. Mm-hmm. I didn't really realize the scale of what was in there. And like that one shot of those pipes, you could repeat that, I don't know, 20 times. There are rooms and rooms and rooms of pipes that look like that. And why is that? Because each kind of pipe makes a different sound. There's the small metal pipes that are like brass instruments. There are wooden pipes that make the sounds of flutes or violins. There are even percussion elements inside that organ. So it's kind of a stupendous kind of exploration.
Absolutely. Still played today, we should say. And it's Macy's, but still played today. Yeah. But I'm also thinking, what does this tell us, Nathaniel, about Philadelphia at this time, that someone was willing to invest 30,000 pipes for an organ for people to go shopping?
It tells us, Marty, I think, of the enormous ambition that this city always has possessed. That is, you know, over many periods of history, Philadelphia has built or tried to build the tallest building in the world. And
has not been able to do we should say.
I mean, it did, going back to Christ Church, which was a long time ago the tallest building in North America. So the organ is a flight of fancy that said we can spend ridiculous amount of money to transport the organ from the St. Louis World's Fair on a train all the way across the country to Philadelphia, installed in a brand new store in 1911 that was supposed to be like a palazzo, and then play it on opening day to a courtyard filled of people, discover that it wasn't anywhere near loud enough, and then build it over the next 30 years to a size in which it would make the sound that was desired. And what is that? It tells us about a place that took itself seriously, that thought big, and that valued the experience of people.
Well, you know, Peter, I'm thinking that Philadelphia and Philadelphians often described as being modest, having an inferiority complex or some version of that. This is not the Philadelphia that we're talking about. This is a Philadelphia that thinks broadly and bigly, I will say that.
Right. City Hall, largest masonry structure in the world, tallest to this day, I believe. What happened to that late 19th century ambition?
Kind of and bravado.
I would say that the late 19th century was maybe an aberration, and the modesty was the underlying characteristic the entire time, and it just reasserted itself, but I couldn't prove it.
Yeah, but for a moment,
we
thought we were pretty cool. You don't agree. Well, no. Hold on to that thought, because I do want to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. In fact, you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, talking about a time in Philadelphia history called, at least called by our guests, as the long 19th century, probably from the middle 19th century into the 20th, and they've collaborated on a book called Philadelphia, Finding the Hidden City. Much more to talk about after this very short break. And again, our guests are Joseph Elliott, Nathaniel Popkin, and Peter Woodall. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Joseph Elliott, Nathaniel Popkin, and Peter Woodall, and they have collaborated on a new book, Philadelphia, the Hidden City, about the architecture and history of what they call the long 19th century. Well, I always like a good debate or discussion. Nathaniel, just a quick response, because you didn't exactly line up with what Peter Woodall was saying.
Well, of course, I believe everything Pete says, because he knows so much, and he's always right. But he is right. There is a modesty that characterizes city and always has, in different ways, and it presents in different forms. However, we would be wrong and remiss not to look at the ways in which Philadelphia has always been almost more ambitious than it should have been. And, you know, looking at the size of buildings is one kind of silly way of assessing that. But yes, from Christ Church, which was the tallest building in North America, to the buildings of the 1876 World's Fair, which were the largest buildings in the world. And they innovated, temporary structural techniques. So they took those buildings down and recycled. So there was a lot of ambitious thinking. And Frank Taylor, you know, who you quoted earlier in terms of the time schedule of Philadelphia in 1916, also talked so much about these pioneering things. Because starting probably with Benjamin Franklin, this was and continued to be a place of ambition and innovation and creativity.
Let me turn back to you, Joseph, and I do want to talk a little bit about the Reading Railroad. And I was getting a little nostalgic before the show began, saying, well, I remember as a younger person, you know, taking the train and it would end at Reading Terminal. Which, of course, has been transformed with the convention center and all of that. There's a photograph in here, and this is, I guess, one of the tunnels of the railroad. For you, Joseph, it's beautiful. It's haunting. Is it possible for you to describe this photograph to our listeners?
Sure. You're looking at a abandoned railroad right away almost underneath the art museum, if you can believe it. The juxtaposition of these sort of subterranean sites is just amazing. It's really hard to connect what's above ground with what's below ground, but this is literally across the street from the art museum, and this is a line that was that is partially still in use. There's actually parallel lines there that don't show up in the picture. There's actually two tunnels next to each other, but the one we're looking at is taking us in toward the center of the city, where the Reading Railroad ran a line right along Vine Street that provided access to a lot of warehouses and industries. That was a very heavily industrialized area in the 19th century and into the 20th century. So, but the beauty of these places, and you see this also in the photograph on the cover, the sewer tunnel in West Philadelphia. I've also photographed other tunnels in underneath Jersey City that look not so different. But in that period, the construction is absolutely beautiful, with a sort of stone foundation up to about 10 feet high, and then this arched brick vaulting that carries the weight above it. So it's strong enough and wide enough that you could fit four railroad tracks in there. For another thing that's beautiful about it, of course, is that I didn't have to add any light at all to that tunnel. Unlike the sewer tunnel, which was pitch black, the railroad tunnel actually has skylights that are cut, that are gratings to the air above. And I think those were probably put in to carry the smoke of the locomotives out of the tunnel. But they provide this absolutely beautiful light. As a photographer, I always prefer to work with the existing natural light. There's a few photos in the book that I did have to add some light, but this was not one of them. And one of the beauties of photography is that if you leave the shutter open long enough, the camera can collect more light than you can see with your eye. So if you went there to that tunnel now and stood there, it would look quite different. You would not see nearly as much as the camera was able to pick up. This is true of both digital and film cameras.
Sure. Well, and this is an interesting thing to think about, Peter, because there's now the development of the Reading Viaduct. So as much as this is a piece of our past, it also represents something about how we can imagine a future Philadelphia.
Well, you know, sometimes when a great old building is being torn down, people say, wow, they just don't make them like that anymore, right?
Right.
And it's the same with this city branch, is technically what it's called, of the Reading Railroad, this subterranean railroad right-of-way. If you look at just the stonework, it's just incredible looking, even to this day. And so having that as your materials going forward, you can do things with that you can't do if you're starting from scratch.
What are the opportunities you see here, Nathaniel?
Well, I mean, speaking broadly, one thing we talk about in this book and in that we argue is that we look at the city that we inherited today in 2017 as really a ruins, right? It's a ruins of different systems of living, of different economic systems. The Reading Viaduct is a wonderful example of that very idea, right? It was an economic system that really does not exist anymore. And it's a ruins that we inherit. So it provides for us, as did the ruins of ancient Athens for the people who were building Athens in the 19th century, the raw material, in a sense, for the city that we want to be. And that's how we begin to see these as living ruins. The viaduct is a great example of that because it actually plants grow there, right? The spontaneous gardens.
Lots of cool graffiti,
too. Lots of cool graffiti. But and actually, in the book, Joe has photographed this amazing sort of little forest growing down there in the viaduct, and or in the subterranean part in the city branch. And wow, it's such a striking thing.
It's alive.
It's alive. It's alive.
I could jump in here in terms of that look at that little forest, that it looks entirely different. If you walk, you can literally on about, 21st Street, you walk across the bridge, the bridges that look down, where you can look down and see that it looks like a sort of thicket, looks impenetrable. But once you're down inside it and looking out and up, it has a totally different you have a totally different response to it. So it by just changing the vantage point, and I think that's what's happening with kind of contemporary reuse of structures and infrastructures like this. Like the biggest obvious example is the High Line in New York City, is you take something that's utterly sort of unknown and you know, as we keep saying, walked past, and then revision it and look at it from a different point of view, and it becomes something totally different and can be used in a totally different way.
And that's Joseph Elliott along with Nathaniel Popkin and Peter Woodall, our guests in this hour of Radio Times, their new book called Philadelphia, Finding the Hidden City. Let me read a tweet from P. Edward. One of my friends used to tune and play that organ. That would be the Don Wanamaker organ. An email from Daniel. Although too much was lost, thanks Edmund Bacon, so much is still there because it wasn't worth ripping down. Architectural treasures are everywhere. Just to basically underscore what we've been talking about, let's talk about the Church of the Advocate, because this place is alive and well. It was built in 1897 in North Philadelphia. And at that time, Nathaniel, this was a pretty well-to-do part of Philadelphia.
Absolutely. Put it in the context of John Wanamaker's store, and you get, you know, a middle-class neighborhood filled with aspiring people. They wanted to shop in a place that met their aspirations, but they also wanted to go and pray in a place that elevated them in all, you know, in a sacred sense. And so the builders of the Church of the Advocate put together a church that was modeled on the cathedral of 14th and 15th century cathedrals from France and Britain.
Wow.
And you can sense that immediately upon walking in there. Very later on, so buildings in Philadelphia tend to collect layers, and that's something we talk about at length in this book. The Church of the Advocate is such a prime example because time goes by and it collects layer after layer of instinct and impulse in our society after one after the other. And so come to the middle of the 20th century, the demographics of the neighborhood are changing. It becomes a mixed-race congregation. And a man named Father Paul Washington, a famous and wonderful human being.
He was a guest on Radio Times back in the
day.
I'm
sure he was. Yep. I mean, one of the legends of Philadelphia becomes the leader of this church, and he turns it into a center for civil rights organizing and black power even. And in 1974, he commissions two artists to interpret the biblical cycle using the American black experience. And so now we have inside that building layers that you can see and sense and feel them. And the murals are incredible. And what Joe has done in his photographs of them is make those layers plain, from the French stonework and the architecture to the stained glass that was originally installed in 1897, to these murals that were installed in 1974. And it really takes you to a different place.
Yeah.
It elevates your experience of being there.
I mean, in certain ways, go ahead. Go ahead, Joseph.
Just one little comment on that. Yeah, that juxtaposition, I think if in the book, it's in the photo, it's also about the colors and the light. You know, the murals themselves are these fiery red, and then in the background, that stonework, and we go off into I think it's the baptistery off to the right, which is a very cool light. So there's this kind of warm, cool juxtaposition that really makes that sort of that pop.
Well, and I think Peter, in some ways, is an example of a building that could have just literally disappeared, been hidden or torn down, but it's been regenerated over the last 100 years.
Sure. I mean, we've seen lots of congregations leave the city, and there's not always a congregation to take their place. And when that happens, a lot of times there's not another use for that building, not immediately. The building deteriorates and it gets torn down. We've seen probably dozens in the last 10 years where that's happened. So having that continuous use, having a congregation that found a new use for it and also made its own, made the building its own in a profound way so that it identified with the building and cared about the building, that's important because they're not the congregation. Well, they are the congregation that started the building, the Episcopalians, right? No.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yes.
That's okay.
It never changed being the same church.
Right.
Yep. Right. I would like to just throw in here that
sure.
It's not all rosy, like, oh, they saved it and it's doing great. It's still a struggle. It's a big building. It needs continuous maintenance, and funds are still short. So we feel like the survival, to me, the survival of a place like the Advocate is still ongoing. It's an ongoing issue. And I think that's a lot of what is the tension or the what's fascinating to me about these kinds of places is that sort of current day status that includes both the sort of grand past but the contemporary reality of needing to survive and go forward. And places like the Advocate and the outer, farther away from the core of the center of the city are still, you know, in a tenuous position.
Yeah. I mean, in certain ways, it's a practical issue. These are big buildings, and that requires a lot of maintenance and heat and all those kinds of things. Let me get Morgan from, looks like, West Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Morgan. Go ahead. You're on the air.
There. I am just calling from one of these 19th century larger manufacturing buildings that's being repurposed by artists right now, very much what you're talking about right now. I just wanted to bring up that these buildings are really in jeopardy of being taken over by developers and turned into, you know, university housing and things of that nature. And it's sad for us to see, and it's a constant struggle to not have that happen. And, you know, we don't have ownership and things like that. And I suggest that that's a sort of phenomenon with these buildings across the city, West Philly, Old City, Fishtown, wherever it is. So I just wanted to bring that up.
Sure. And Morgan, just what building are you referring to?
I'm not going to name it specifically because, you know, they are always under the eye of developers.
I got you. Fair enough. No, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Anything you want to add to what our caller said? If not, I have many more questions for you. Peter, did you want to add something?
No, let's keep going.
There were, I guess in the heyday of movie houses, there were hundreds.
There were
hundreds
almost
of movie
500.
Houses in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
At the beginning of what, talkies and silent films and all of that?
I would say by the 1920s. So you had a combination of places that had been built in the late 19th century that were legitimate theaters. And then you had vaudeville houses. And you also had Nickelodeons, which were much smaller buildings where they showed penny movies or nickel movies. So when you had all three of those types, you had them by the 20s. And that's when you had the largest concentration.
Hundreds and hundreds, yeah.
And then you had movie palaces that were built, you know, in the teens.
People would get dressed up to go to the movies.
And they would want to because, again, they were to enter a magic world. And so the vestiges of that are still here on our commercial streets. Sometimes you can't recognize them. And one thing we want to do with this book is to help the reader to see and go along on the journey with us to find the hidden city. And that vital public commercial world is there if you know how to look for it.
Which seems like the perfect question to put to our photographer, Joseph. How do you suggest just regular people who aren't professional photographers, how should we then look at Philadelphia and look for these things that we've been talking about?
Well, that's a really good question. I think the first thing I would say is just to take time to look and not to really think about, well, can I make a good picture or can I get this? You know, because there's so much now about people with the smartphones shooting pictures of everything, or I was here or I was there. And it really takes some time, I think, to see what to see what we're looking at. So that would be the first thing I would say, is to take time to look and to move slowly and stop and look. The second thing I would point out in this book is that almost all the pictures are interiors. We can learn quite a lot by looking at the exterior of a building or a site or a location or context. But for us, I think, for me, the penetrating, going inside and being sort of surrounded by that place is what moves me. So to be able to get inside, now I don't know, I can't say how to do that. Sometimes it helps to know someone or to ask. Sometimes you can just knock on the door. I've done this many times especially with smaller sites like, say, Storz Tools. The Storzes are there. You walk in and start talking and describe your interest, and many times people will be willing to be actually kind of charmed that you're actually interested in what they do or where they are.
We're almost out of time here. Let me just toss out, do you have an unfair question? Do you have a favorite place, Nathaniel?
No, fair enough. But I will say one thing is that through a long observation of the city and working with Peter and Joe has, after 30 years, I'm beginning to see Philadelphia differently. And so while I don't have one favorite place, I'm beginning to see favorite places in ways I'd never seen them before.
A perfect way to end our discussion. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times, Joseph Elliott, Nathaniel Popkin, and Peter Whittle. And we've been talking about their book, Philadelphia, Finding the Hidden City, published by Temple University Press. After this very short break, Symphony for a Broken Orchestra. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain. There's going to be an unusual concert this Sunday night at the 23rd Street Armory in Philadelphia. Symphony for a Broken Orchestra, written by Pulitzer Prize-winning composer David Lang, will have its debut performed on broken musical instruments from the School District of Philadelphia. Our guest, Rob Blackson, asked music teachers to drop off broken instruments at Temple Contemporary, where he is art director. He received about 1,000 of them, hung some on the walls of the gallery, and got the idea for a symphony. These instruments can also be adopted, fixed, and returned to the schools for students to play. Rob Blackson joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
Also with us is Selena Valles, and she is music teacher at Pan American Academy Charter School. And Selena, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Nice to have you with us. And she has brought some instruments which she will be playing during this portion of the show. Let me go first to you, Rob, though. What sparked this idea?
Well, it goes back more than 2 years now. You may remember that back in 2013, the School District of Philadelphia closed over 24 schools across the city, mostly in communities of color. And as part of our work at Temple Contemporary, we often do our programming in response to an advisory council that's drawn from people from all across the city. And as we were doing this work and wondering about these closed schools, my assistant director, Sarah B. Miller, and myself wandered into a closed gymnasium that was full of broken pianos.
And just sitting there in the gymnasium?
Yeah, because what had happened, this was in a school in South Philadelphia that was kind of the repository, the warehouse, that a lot of the instruments from across the district got pushed into because the district was kind of clearing them out so they could be sold. And when we walked in there and saw that, it was kind of the tip of the iceberg. We're wondering, okay, well, if there's this many of these, how many more are there? And that's when we started to talk to Frank Makos, who's the director of music education at the School of Philadelphia. And it was from there that we started to understand the scope of the problem. And it, to put it into financial terms, back in 2007, there was a budget of $1.3 million to support music education across the school district. But you roll the clock ahead just 10 years, and now the budget is about $50,000 for the entire
$50,000
for the entire school district. So you can imagine, you know, a child stumbles in marching band practice or the bridge on a violin snaps. That's just one less instrument for a kid to play in the schools. And it was under that understanding and talking to music teachers really throughout the district, what they would always say is, you know, I have kids coming through my doors every day who are so excited to play music, but unfortunately, I just can't give them one that works. And what we began to learn was that the teachers had been kind of stockpiling these instruments for years in the hopes that one day their budgets would be restored. And so they had really instrument graveyards in their storerooms, their cupboards, their basements, all across the schools. And we started to ask them, would you bring them to us? And we'll try to figure out a way to repair them.
Well, let me get our school teacher here, Selena Velez, and she has brought some instruments with her. Maybe Selena, and we have John Aarons who's going to be handing you some of these instruments, and it looks like you are about to get a violin. First of all, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times, and tell us about this violin.
So this instrument comes from G.W. Childs Elementary School in the Point Breeze section of the city. It is a violin that is missing its fingerboard. So you would normally put your fingers on, there's like a huge gap, and there's only two strings on it. It was actually strung as a viola, which has the same body and shape as a violin, but the strings are much lower to give it a deeper sound. So without the fingerboard, it makes it very interesting to play.
Oh, wow.
I promise I'm a professional.
Yeah, and so you're sliding
really
your finger. Right.
Yeah, but for a child, this would be impossible to play. It would hurt their fingers way too much. And without access to quality instruments, it's really difficult to get our next generation of musicians.
Are you going to be performing on Sunday night?
Yes, I'm also a section leader.
And what will you be playing?
I will be playing this instrument.
This
particular instrument is my instrument. I took it because I've had, in my classes, fingerboards pop off. I've had bridges pop off. And there's a lot that you can learn how to jerry-rig on the fly when you're a music teacher, but there's some things that are just irreparable.
Well, I'm curious about, as a musician yourself, I mean, you can look at a broken instrument and say, well, this is not playable. This is a broken instrument. Do you hear and see possibilities in
Absolutely.
This broken instrument?
So the structure of this, it really has some great structural integrity. There have been other examples that we've brought that are completely destroyed. There's cellos with holes in them. There are trumpet bells that have been crushed. There are missing valves and some other instruments which can be repaired, but without it, you can't make the traditional sounds.
Yeah.
So instead, what we've done is that we take, with the help of the Found Sound people, have found different ways of being able to play these instruments.
All right, you should describe what you have.
For example, now I have a clarinet that has some broken keys in it, so it won't be able to make all of the tones that it normally would make. It's super, super squeaky. However, if you listen carefully, we can still use those keys that are still broken to make other sounds. And that's really part of this symphonic work, is that we're using these instruments in non-traditional ways. We've gone
Is that hard?
It was so hard for me
to
professional
go from
musician.
Something that feels predictable and
exactly.
perhaps even melodic.
Well, that's really one of the interesting things about this piece. This piece has a lot of times in it where you're encouraged to play the instruments in different ways. There's a cello that the sound post has fallen, and there are no strings on it. So we just roll around the instrument so that you can hear the rattling of this sound post that's inside. You hear the clickety-clack of different instruments that have valves or that have keys. And so it's wonderful to be able to show my students, to show the people in the orchestra, and to show the audience that there's music all around us if you're looking hard enough.
That's so interesting. Is this, Rob, is this what you envisioned as you thought, well, maybe we'll do a symphony for broken instruments? Or was that your idea? Or you just thought there's something playable in these broken instruments?
I think what this project and with the upcoming concert will allow for is a chance for the city to get an understanding of the scope of the problem. And that was really important for us, is that this would be a moment where all of Philadelphia and all the musicians from all different stripes and worlds of the music industry of Philadelphia can come together to understand where the scope of this problem is really going. And that was, I think, one of the fundamental, I guess I could say, benefits of doing this project, is that we're getting members of the Philadelphia Orchestra to sit side by side with a 12-year-old, because when you hand them each broken instruments, there's a leveling that goes on that I think connects them in a way to music beyond just what it is the instrument can actually do or not do.
And how did you get David Lang involved? He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning composer. How did he get involved in this project?
David was in many ways the easiest catch.
Really?
Yeah. I sent him a message, and he responded within 5 minutes.
He said, "Sign me up."
Yes. David himself is a product of public education, and he, in many ways, I think, kind of sees public education as his foot in the door to learning what he now understands music can be. And so it was from that invitation of saying, would you be interested to do something with the broken instruments of Philadelphia in the public schools, that he definitely wanted to sign on right away.
You have another instrument there, Selena.
Yeah.
And I thank you for bringing in all these instruments.
So what I have in here right now in my hands is a flute. It's a Gemeinhardt flute, so it's a good quality flute. But there are broken keys inside that, or broken rods and springs, I should say, which makes it really hard to produce a sound here.
So inside the flute, there are broken.
There are keys and rods inside here that help move the pads up and down. And when a spring goes off, it literally has cut in half the ability of the flute. Only the bottom section works, and not the top half. And there are several instruments that we have in the collection that are like that, where part of it will work, or there's a limited range, maybe, per se.
Tell us about the students at your school, Pan American Academy Charter School.
Sure. So Pan American Academy Charter School is now celebrating its 10th year. We have 753 students. It is one of the city's few bilingual schools. It's also an IB World School, so we are host to the primary years program, as well as the middle school program from the International Baccalaureate people. My students are very lucky that I'm employed there full time, and we have a full time art teacher. And because of that, I'm able to do so many more things with my students. I see them from K to 8, so that's 9 years that we're together. I currently have a violin, I call them Virtuoso Violin Club. We meet on our common lunch on once a week. And I have 15 students, because in my 10 years of teaching, I've been able to collect from donations and from buying at thrift stores and whatnot, 15 violins. But I always have a wait list of students that want to get in, students that beg me. There are currently right now 8 students on the wait list. But music has been playing a very important part in my life and in my students' lives. And we're hoping that through quality music education programs, we can keep on creating the next generation of musicians. And I think that this piece highlights that you can have a very wide range of what does it mean to be a musician.
Well, and I love the idea of members, Rob, of the Philadelphia Orchestra sitting next to a 15-year-old or an 8-year-old or an amateur musician who sees the possibilities in this instrument that they're holding?
No, it's definitely. I mean, I think it's historically renowned and understood that Philadelphia's orchestra, at one point, many musicians came from the public schools, and now increasingly that's becoming more of a challenge. And so I know, specifically speaking with Joseph Conyers, who plays principal bass in the orchestra, he's terribly excited to play in the concert because he sees this as the introduction to what will hopefully be one of his colleagues. So, yeah, it's a nice story for him.
Let me get, looks like Pam from Cherry Hill, New Jersey, to join our conversation. Hi, Pam. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I adopted one of your instruments.
Oh, thank you so much.
That's great. Thank you.
I adopted a flute, and the reason is I have a 10-year-old who is, he's in fifth grade, and he happens to play the flute. And so, you know, I read the article in the Inquirer, must have been last winter or spring, and it just broke my heart to think that all these instruments could not be played by children who were waiting to play instruments. So I live in Cherry Hill, and we have a pretty robust music program. And so I was glad and honored to help in a small
That's
way
great.
That I could.
Good for
thank
you, Kim.
You so
thank you so much.
In fact,
you.
When I opened
you're
up,
you're welcome.
Yeah, thanks. No, go ahead.
When I opened up my violin, I found a note in there from 2007, and it was from Mr. Saidi, apparently a string teacher, and it said, you know, please bring in $6.50 so you can get your music book. And I just wanted to cry because that meant that since 2007, this instrument has been in such disrepair that no one has been able to learn to play the violin since that 10 years. And in 10 years, we could have produced how many musicians out of this one instrument? So I'm really glad that we are tackling this problem and that there's been so much awareness. The public support has been amazing. You can still adopt some instruments. There are several instruments that are still available for adoption. And it's really been exciting to see people from the community, parents. I was conducting one of the rehearsals, and I had two sets of parents there with their kids, and it was great to see them sitting side by side and learning how to try and read the score, because it's a different kind of a
like
score.
And what does the score look like?
So the score, I counted it up, there are literally only 71 bars of music in the score, and it goes on for like 12 pages. And most of it is just written. Most of it is instructions saying, play it softly, or go wild and crazy, or everyone can come in at a different time. And so that creating melody and music and a cohesive unit out of such random parts, I think, speaks to the nature of the instruments, speaks to David's amazing, the composer David Lang's amazing ability to create sound and camaraderie and a piece of art out of this seeming chaos.
And Rob, where will you be Sunday night?
I'll be in the audience hoping that all goes well. I'm not very musical myself, but no, I'm really handing it over in many ways as often as I can to the musicians themselves, because they really are the spirit of the project, as well as the people who have been choosing to adopt instruments.
How does someone do that?
It's very simple. You just simply go on to our website, 74brokenorchestra.org, and you'll see like a cascading sheet of instruments. Some of them have big hearts on them that say, I'm adopted. Other ones don't. And for those that don't, you can read about those instruments. You can listen to what they sound like now in their broken state. And then you can choose to adopt. All money goes directly to the fund for the School District of Philadelphia. And that money will go directly then to instrument repairs and replacements.
This was also you're the art director of Temple Contemporary.
Yes.
I finally said that correctly there. but you also use this as an exhibition, right?
Well, yeah. Again, it's that idea of trying to see the scope of the problem. And so lining our walls with all of these broken instruments, when people walked in, you couldn't help but be moved by the sense of recognizing that each of those instruments represents a kid who yet doesn't have that ability to be able to play music.
But also represents the history of that instrument. I mean, whether someone tripped and fell when they were in a marching band, or whether it just got used and played and played and played and played until it couldn't be played anymore.
Some of these instruments are antiques, going back to, I believe, the 20s. So they've been used for generations of musicians throughout the school district. So really important, I think, cultural artifacts of our commitment to music in the public schools. And we hope to continue that.
Cillian, how are you going to prepare for Sunday night's performance?
I'm super excited. I'm going to read through my score again, of course. There are a few little things that I need to touch up on the instrument, but it has just been wonderful to sit side by side to some of these musicians and to go through this journey together.
Yeah. Well, it's a terrific project, and I thank you both for coming in, and I thank you both for your involvement in the project. Symphony for a Broken Orchestra will be having its debut this Sunday night at the 23rd Street Armory in Philadelphia. And joining us, Rob Blackson, and he is the art director for Temple Contemporary. Rob, thank you for coming into Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
And also with us, Selena Velez, and she's a music teacher at Pan American Academy Charter School. Thank you, Selena, for coming in as well. And also check out a video that we will be posting later today on our Facebook page of some of the instruments that we were talking about on the radio. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.